Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
And about... Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Hello, welcome to Know the Faith, Defend the Faith. My name is William Hemsworth, and thank you so much for joining me for this week's program. I'm very excited to have my guest on, Efren Meni. He has a popular blog called Meni Thoughts. Great follow on Twitter and an awesome podcast called Priestly Passion. Efren, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. How you doing this morning? Or hey, it's morning where you at?
It's morning where I'm at. It's 9:05. Yeah. No, so thank you. So our topic today, well, first and foremost, happy anniversary to you and your lovely wife.
Thank you so much. Five years a day. Couldn't be happy.
That's awesome. That's amazing. Marriage is such a great blessing. And again, congratulations. Now, our topic today, we had talked about this, early last month before, I guess, stuff got all crazy in the world. But we're going to talk about the contribution of African-Americans to Catholicism in the United States.
Right.
And the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is because of your post on Twitter during February. A lot of stuff I had no idea about. So, again, I just want to thank you for coming on. It's a privilege to have you on.
Yeah, those posts were really eye-opening for a lot of people. So that was good to know.
No, they were definitely eye-opening. And it's funny because I consider myself a student of church history, but I hadn't heard about a lot of those things. So I had to go back and start researching, which was a great thing. As like I said, it was eye-opening for me as well. But you've been featured on Big Pulpit a couple times, and one of the, which is a great honor, you're doing great work. But one of your articles was about Saint Peter Claver. If I'm not mistaken, he's your patron saint.
Right. And so how I went about finding Peter Claver was, I guess during RCIA, it's always encouraged that you, or it's mandatory that you sort of find a confirmation saint that you can. Find somebody to imitate Christ to, or Christ, somebody you can ask for intercessions for, you know, all that good stuff in the faith. And I think in December or so, I bought a book at the Half Price Bookstore, like 365 Days of Saints or something like that. And so for some time, I was just skimming through the book, not going in any chronological order, but just going through. And, you know, I didn't really find anybody, despite, you know, their remarkable records and, you know, achievements. Saint Augustine, the Irenaeuses, the Francis de Sales, you know, all those wonderful figures, but I didn't think they spoke to me, because I guess your confirmation saint is somebody's supposed to speak to you and everything right. that you feel. And so I was just flipping through one day, and then I came to September 9th, and I read the entry on Saint Peter Claver, and I was just immediately blown away by, you know, although there's very short, you know, 200, you know, entry on him. I ended up reading his biography by John Slattery and was just really amazed. And if I may talk a little bit about him right now.
Please.
Yeah, so St. Peter Claver was a Jesuit Spanish priest. You know, he just like many saints, he was born in nobility, a wealthy, prominent family. But somehow during the line, you know, he felt the call to the priesthood. And so he ended up going to a seminary. And so while in seminary, he ended up meeting St. Afonsus Rodriguez. And he was just like a lay porter, but he was extremely wise. And he ended up forming St. Peter Claver's, you know, whole like worldview and his mission that he would go on to go in Cartagena, Colombia with. So St. Afonsus and Peter Claver, you know, would meet and talk all the time. And so upon him finishing seminary, St. Peter Claver goes to Cartagena, Colombia on the advice from St. Afonsus. And St. Peter Claver gets there and he's already following the work of a predecessor named Alfonso de Sandoval, who was already there in Colombia, you know, doing similar work with slaves at one of the largest ports in the hemisphere. So Alfonso de Sandoval was, another pivotal player who isn't really recognized in the New World with the slave trade. But anyway, St. Peter Claver sort of picks up the missionary baton from Alfonso de Sandoval. And, you know, St. Peter Claver hits the ground running with these slaves on the ship. So, you know, the slave trade from Congo to South America was a huge trek for these slaves to endure on the ship. You know, rancid conditions, you know, many slaves were thrown off the boat and fed to, you know, whatever wild aquatic life. And so the slave trade was, the ship conditions were, you know, unbearable. And so St. Peter Claver would just go in like nothing and, you know, administer to the slaves once they hit Cartagena, Colombia. He would, you know, immediately tend to their physical needs, like give them food, water. And, you know, along the way, he encountered a lot of, you know, hostility between, you know, those Spanish owners. But, you know, St. Peter Claver continued to do his work. And even when the slaves got off the ship, he would have a huge, you know, apostolate and mission, ministry, evangelizing and providing catechesis with the slaves. And, you know, it's said that he baptized some 300,000 slaves, but, you know, that's a conservative number. Some estimate even more than that. But he wasn't also, I mean, they call him the apostle of the slaves, but, you know, he also evangelized, you know, Protestants, Muslims, and anybody who entered and frequented, you know, the port of Cartagena, Colombia. And so when he was canonized in the 19th century, him and his formation or spiritual director, St. Afonso Rodriguez, both were canonized together as like a, you know, a powerful, strong bond that these two men shared. And plus it was a, you know, a defining moment for St. Peter Claver in his canonization because, you know, so much globally was happening with the slave trade and, you know, many countries were abolishing the slave trade, but slavery was still a huge practice and institution still in that time. So to have St. Peter Claver canonized at the time was a powerful message for human rights and the dignity of the human person globally.
So what is it that drew you to him initially?
Yeah. So something I really thought about St. Peter Claver, as I said before, as I was going through, you know, the St. Francis de Sales and the St. Augustines, you know, these were, you know, very remarkable figures in church history and doctors of the churches. But, you know, I didn't feel the personal connection to them. But something that it got me when I read St. Peter Claver was like the personal connection of a slave. And I think that's I think the slave has like two meanings to it. Like apparently those slaves are from Africa. And, you know, I'm African, Black American here in America, and I'm a descendant of those people that St. Peter Claver, you know, evangelized. So definitely that sort of spoke to me. And then in addition, you know, just thinking about being a slave to Jesus or just being a slave and then being free and then living for Christ. I think that was a powerful, like, you know, like a little metaphor. Like, yeah, you were once a slave in your own passions and desires, but then Christ liberated you to, you know, something way more fulfilling and righteous. And so that double fold meaning of, you know, identifying myself with, you know, all the other Africans that's dispersed across the world and South America and the Caribbean and Europe and Asia and in Native Africa, and, you know, the theological implications of, you know, being free from slavery or sin spoke to me very, very much.
Oh, that's awesome. Amen. Now, in February, you had, like I said, you had many posts in February. What are some of the contributions of African Americans to Catholicism in the United States?
Yeah,
that's so, kind of a broad question.
Yeah, so to just piggyback on people who are not familiar, back in February during Black History Month, you know, I guess every day I did like a small daily trivia fact about something in Black history. And so I just did it. Well, originally I didn't do it. I didn't know what I was doing at first, but it just evolved into something after the second day of February. I was like, oh, maybe I should keep running with this because it seems like a lot of people are private messaging me about it and all this kind of stuff. So basically it was just 28 days of, I guess, Black Catholic trivia and like facts that really was popular for a lot of people. But one thing I think about, I mean, there's so many contributions about, you know, Black Catholic history. But I think, I mean, for me, when I think about Black Catholic history, I think the biggest contribution that Black Catholics could offer or African Americans could offer the church is just freely being available to the church. And I think one example of that that's really, really powerful happened after the Civil War, of course. You know, after the Civil War, you know, I guess it was the Negro problem, as many people, you know, commonly refer to. And that was like, hey, what are we going to do with all these slaves now that, you know, some conservative estimate 4 million are free? And so I think at that moment, the church had a good opportunity to, you know, capitalize and, you know, reap that spiritual harvest that they wanted for so long. And so it was a guy named Archbishop Martin Spalding of Baltimore, you know, and he wasn't a big fan of, he wasn't the biggest fan of the slaves and the slaves at all, but he saw it necessary that, you know, these newly freed people have some right to religious education and spiritual education. And so Archbishop Spalding, you know, said, hey, all other brother bishops in America, we need to get together and create a council where we can address the, you know, spiritual and religious needs of these newly freed Black people in America. And, you know, he submitted to Rome his petition. The propaganda or the Congregation of Propaganda, you know, gave him the AOK green light. And they even named him Archbishop Spalding, the apostle or apostolic delegate to this council that they were going to create. And so some of the things that the people or the bishops were going to discuss during this time were like Black vocations, having men and women enter the seminary. They were going to create, you know, seminaries for African Americans, having a national, I guess, like overseer over this nationwide platform to, you know, evangelize and provide spiritual and religious needs of African Americans. They were going to appoint, ultimately, they were going to appoint Spalding to this post. But, you know, a lot of bishops ended up seeing that as, you know, horrible, and they didn't like that approach. So, you know, the second plenary council begins, and all the bishops in America at the time address everything but the issue at the main table. So they address every other theological, spiritual question, but the question of what to do with the religious needs of African Americans. So Archbishop Spalding, you know, he comes along again and says, hey, we need to have another extraordinary council to really get down to this issue. And so piggybacking again, you know, they wanted to have this national overseer bishop who would, you know, patrol and make sure every bishop was following the recommendations from Rome about how to address the spiritual and needs of African Americans. But the bishop didn't like that because, you know, they didn't want their, you know, you don't want your power to be supplanted, and you want to do everything on your own, and you don't want to have nobody telling you what to do. And so many bishops just completely objected to, you know, this new idea that was presented by Archbishop Martin Spalding in Rome about how to, you know, effectively address the spiritual needs of the African Americans. And so what ultimately happens after the council is that, you know, the bishops agree, like, hey, we need to just do what's best for our own diocese. And, you know, some of the bishops ultimately, you know, do little small piecemeal things, but nothing really to combat the solution of Black vocations, religious needs, and seminaries. But then again, majority of bishops just go off to do the same old same reticence and abstention practices that they've done before. And so I bring that up as just like a, I mean, it's a contribution in a sense that, you know, African-Americans were freely available and, right. you know, we could have contributed ourselves to the church and, you know, we were available, but, you know, the failure of the bishops at the time, but you had some bishops, you know, not all the bishops, but you maybe you had a few bishops who were super enthused about this new plan from Rome, but, you know, the bishops just wouldn't want to get along with it. And so ultimately what happened is, the bishops go to their diocese and some do little small things, but the bishops ultimately ask for European missionaries to come since they don't want to, you know, lift the weight themselves. So they petition to have, you know, European missionaries to come to America. And, you know, ultimately that wish would get fulfilled in 1871, I think, with the Mars Hill Fathers, who were, you know, British missionaries dedicated to, you know, the missions in Africa. But, you know, they saw a bountiful harvest in America with the new slaves. So the Mars Hill Fathers came and, you know, Archbishop Spalding was super happy because, you know, finally somebody's here to, you know, evangelize and, you know, address the needs of these African-Americans. So, you know, that's a, I think that's a very, you know, profound moment. I mean, when I look back on Black Catholic history in America, like, man, it wasn't the best plan, but it was a plan.
It was a start.
Yeah.
So what did Archbishop Spalding ultimately do in his region?
Archbishop Spalding, you know, he never ceased that, you know, trying to get the missions and, you know, the evangelistic needs of African-Americans. He just kept going and, you know, he did some things that he did the best that he could do. But ultimately, you know, he wanted a national, you know, platform for African-Americans. But, you know, Archbishop Spalding did get his... ultimately got his wish granted, but he died, you know, in 1872, I think, after the Mars Fathers came to America from Britain. So yeah, he came, I mean, they came and they fulfilled his wish by, you know, having a group of men come who were extremely zealous and had extreme fervor for, you know, the mission for African Americans, but, you know, he didn't live to see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
When the missionaries came, did they go to one location or did they disperse throughout the country?
Yeah, so I think the Mars Hill Father, you know, really typically focused in the Northeast area. You know, that was like in the Baltimore area.
Okay.
And so, and another thing good about Black Catholic history too is that, you know, when we look back at Black Catholic history, you know, Black Catholics have typically been like central and like the Gulf Coast area, like New Orleans.
Right.
You know, in not ancient times, but, you know, colonial times, St. Augustine, Florida had a very thriving, you know, population of Black Catholics at that time in St. Augustine, Florida. And it's one of the pivotal city for, you know, Black Catholic history. And then Maryland, you know, was also, you know, a pivotal area for Black Catholic history. So, you know, along the Northeast, and, you know, the Gulf Coast area of the Southeast United States, you know, there were like strong pockets of Black Catholics existing way before, you know, 1800s.
Okay. Now, one of the people you had talked about is Venerable Henriette DeLisle. Did I say that name right?
Yeah. Henriette DeLisle of New Orleans. She's a pivotal player in Black Catholic history. And I think the thing that makes Henriette DeLisle comes alive is because she has like a twofold story that I think that's powerful. So, you know, Henriette DeLisle, you know, is mixed race Creole woman. You know, her father is, you know, French or Spanish. And then her mother is, you know, mixed race Creole Black woman. And so she grows up and she's, you know, pretty fair skinned. And she has the, she grows up in New Orleans and, you know, has the pomp and elegance of the wealthy class because of the system that they grew up in called placage. And so placage was basically a horrible system. I mean, it's really a horrible system now we think about it. Was a system in place by the French and Spanish where they could come to, you know, mate and have, you know, mistresses basically with slaves and Native Americans without necessarily having the sacramental aspect of it. So they could have, wow, you know, mistresses and, you know, common law marriage, basically, the slaves and new women without necessarily, you know, marrying them. And so Henriette DeLille, you know, grows up in that system of placage and, you know, New Orleans. She grows up, has all the pomp, elegance, you know, she knows French, she grows and, you know, goes to Gap parties and like all the elegant stuff. Her mom is like super wealthy. And, you know, one thing that happens in her life is that she knows that, you know, slaves don't have it the best. And so she goes to minister and act out. I mean, because it's forbidden for slaves to read and write at this time, she goes to act out certain scenes of the Bible of and salvation history to the slaves, you know, to give them religious education. But something happens to Henriette DeLille. She has a profound religious experience. And especially when her mom dies, you know, she gives away, in true saint fashion, she gives away all her inheritance. And so Henriette DeLille also, you know, because she's so fair skinned, you know, she can pass as white, but she decides to align and identify herself with African-Americans during this time. And so, you know, that comes with a whole bunch of baggage in itself because, you know, you get you're subjugated to, you know, attacks and harsh treatment and, you know, not the best treatment in the 19th century America for African-Americans. And so Henriette DeLille does these two things. And along with her friends, she ended up creating the Sisters of the Holy Family, which is, you know, the second religious congregation for Black women in America, next to the Oblate Sisters of Providence that happened, you know, 20 some years before. But the Sisters of the Holy Family in New Orleans end up doing, you know, phenomenal social work, meeting the needs of Black men and women who are, you know, in desperate need of, you know, goods, services, relief, education. And so Henriette DeLille and, you know, her two and her other accomplices that, you know, form the Sisters of the Holy Family ended up accomplishing a lot of, you know, good in the New Orleans area in just, so you know, a short amount of time with what they had available. And so I think when I think back on Henriette DeLille, especially the fact that she, one, you know, willingly gave up her inheritance and, you know, chose to identify and align herself with African-Americans, and the fact that she, you know, broke down the gender barrier and the sex barrier of marriage during that time, because she was expected to, you know, grow up in the placage system. Her mother was grooming her as a prime candidate because she wanted her to, you know, have a life of, you know, good and not struggle. And her mom was grooming her for that placage system, but she willingly didn't want that and chose to dedicate herself to, you know, poverty and, you know, giving a selfless life to the needs of others who definitely had it way worse in New Orleans at the time.
Now, how about in the 20th century? Is there any key figures in the 20th century that helped helped with the contribution?
Yeah, so some in the 20th century, somebody I think is super important is Thomas Turner Wyatt. I think Thomas Turner Wyatt, how I like to characterize, you know, Black Catholic history is in three parts. So you have basically the pre-colonial part, which is, you know, you have these small pockets of growing Black areas in America, in the Gulf Coast, in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. That's from, you know, the beginning of the arrivals of the settlers to, you know, 1800s or so. Right. And from the 1800s to about, I like to say somewhere in the early 19th or the 20th century, you have this period of striving for, making your voice heard and, you know, striving for legitimacy in the church. And so you see figures like Henriette DeLille, Augustus Tolton, Daniel Rudd, these type of people come around who want to make, you know, Black people's voice in the church be known and heard and legitimized. And then once you get past, you know, the legitimizing period, you get into like the modern day kind of area, mm-hmm, from early 20th century to, you know, kind of present to now. And so in this period, I think, you know, Blacks just really wanted equality in institutions. And I think what Thomas Turner Wyatt did was really piggyback on the success of Daniel Rudd in the late 19th century in his Colored Congress of basically creating a caucus of the laity of African-Americans. And Thomas Turner ended up doing the same thing, But he creates this new organization where, you know, Black people, especially Black Catholics, or it's mainly for Black Catholics, can, you know, have equality in the seminaries, in the vocations, in the religious schools. You know, so his whole principle is like seeing institutional and systematic, you know, racism and discrimination in these Catholic, white Catholic institutions being dismantled so that African Americans can, you know, achieve full equality in what it means to be a brother and sister of Christ in the Catholic Church. And so I think his movement of the, I want to say it was called the Federated Colored Catholics, was really pivotal in driving equality in institutions. And I think one would be remiss not to include him in a summary of a key pivotal player in the 20th century.
Sure. Now, how about today? What can we do as a church, as a whole, to further everything that these great people in the past started?
Yeah, I think one key thing I think is super beneficial, because when we look at Black Catholic history, is often neglected, and it is neglected. And, you know, when we look at Black Catholic history, we have figures like Blessed Solanus Casey and Elizabeth Ann Seton. You know, these figures, you know, overshadow, and these are great figures, by the way, in American history, and, you know, the remarkable heroic virtues that they did. These figures have done an extreme amount of good. You know, that their stories are popularized and glamorized and, you know, the mainstream Catholic narrative. But, you know, in Black Catholic history, we have just as many, you know, great figures like Henriette DeLille and Augustus Tolton. And, you know, I don't think their stories get as much equality and, like, notoriety just because, you know, Black Catholics don't own, or we don't have that power to own and control the narrative of the mainstream, you know, Catholic world. But what we can do is influence it. And so one thing I think we can definitely do is push for, you know, definitely push for, you know, having African-American history incorporated into American Catholic history, especially in, you know, those homeschooling curriculums and definitely those Catholic schools across the country. I think that's a big thing to see. I have one textbook here, just out of curiosity, that I bought from, you know, a bookstore, a used bookstore, and it doesn't have anything on Black Catholic history in it. And, you know, that's kind of appalling too, because it's like, man, African-Americans have really been from the beginning, from the first settler here, have been, you know, going extremely hard for the Catholic Church and all its contributions, and have tried to make inroads and, you know, find an equality in the only place that we've ever found home, which is the Catholic Church. And to go back to the quote I said the other day, you know, Daniel Rudd said he saw the Catholic Church as the one that could, you know, break the color line. And, you know, that was late 19th century. And the church, you know, had a perfect opportunity, especially after the Civil War, to seize on that. But, you know, the church may never get that same opportunity as it had back then, but the church definitely can play a pivotal role. And definitely one way they can do that is by incorporating Black Catholic history into, you know, the Catholic textbooks. In addition, you know, things that a lot of people have said already today, like, you know, advocating against, you know, speaking out against, you know, racism and, you know, addressing that as a super crucial area, and advocating for just policies that have humane treatment and, you know, death penalty and criminal justice reform is something that the bishops and the clergy can definitely speak out of. And I know a lot of people don't necessarily think the church should be involved in politics, but I think that's just rubbish, because the Catholic Church has always been involved in politics. I think the Catholic Church has been the light in the darkness since the beginning on, you know, reining in the secular world's craziness and madness and bringing back their voice of truth on, like, hey, you guys are not following the commandments and, you know, you're not following natural law. Here's what the church says, and here's what, you know, is natural to all men. So the Catholic Church definitely does have a huge role to play, especially now in America, with all what's going on with the recent events on last month. The Catholic Church can definitely lead on it.
No, couldn't agree more. And like you said, when you started doing all this stuff in February, I had no idea about a lot of this stuff. So it was really eye-opening. And I think I'm not the only one. I'm sure there was a lot of other people that were, a lot of the stuff was eye-opening to them. Now, are there any resources or anything that the listeners can go to learn more about Black Catholic history? Are there any websites out there or anything?
Yeah, I think one website is really good is the National Black Catholic Congress. You know, those guys meet up annually every year to, you know, discuss, you know, the needs of different parishes and talk about the state of, you know, Black Catholics as a whole in the country. And, you know, that's a good tradition that Daniel Rudd started in the late 19th century for 5 years. He had the laity come together for 5 years and then somehow just disbanded. But, you know, the National Black Catholic Congress picked that back up in the late 20th century. And they've been going strong ever since. So that's a good website. And then a lot of people have just asked me, like, hey, what's good books that you should read? And, you know, a lot of people will say different books. But I just think the primer on, you know, Black Catholic history is by Brother Cyprian Davis, The History of Black Catholics in the United States. I think even though it's, you know, came out in the 90s, it still covers, you know, from first arrival to modern times, and it goes in depth in research and footnotes and endnotes, and it has so much wealth to really give you every minute detail in Black Catholic history about figures and places and cities, both white and Black people who did marvelous things for the advancement of you know, Black Catholics in America to see equality in the fullness of the church.
Great. So how about you for a moment? Your blog and your podcast, how are those going?
It's going well. I think the podcast over Priestly Passion is called, sort of like on a standstill because COVID-19, and I had a whole bunch of interviews going, but we had to stop. But I'm hoping to get back in the game with that. As far as me writing, you know, I tend to write, I mean, now that I'm on summer vacation from being an educator, I tend to write more like once a week now. Some things I think I want to address more on the issue of, you know, the churches, just exploring more about Black Catholic history. I think I have something written about Black Catholic history that I finished, touching on that topic of, you know, African Americans after the Civil War, and then just giving my own thoughts on it about how, you know, it wasn't the perfect plan, but it was something to work with that they could have, you know, developed on. So definitely continue to write more. I think it's just, you know, just relaxing.
I agree. What's your blog website?
You're going to put me on the spot. It's at WordPress at manythoughts.com, I think.
Okay, yeah. manythoughts.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
Great blog, a lot of great insights. And Efren, I thank you so much for coming on the program. Any closing thoughts you want to share with the listeners about what we talked about today?
Yeah, I mean, I barely touched on a fragment of, you know, Black Catholic history.
Small portion. Barely,
yeah, a small speck on the grand scheme of, you know, 400 plus years of wisdom. And I would just encourage you to just continue to, everybody wants to, you know, I've received so many direct messages like, hey, what can I do? What can I do? And it's just the best thing to do is just, you know, learn, and not just learn just for the sake of it's trendy or it's cool, but learn genuinely just to, you know, have a deeper appreciation for your neighbor and to love your neighbor better. And listen, you know, listening always helps. Don't be so quick to talk, but listen and hear what others have to say, regardless if they don't look like you or don't share the same opinion.
All right. Amen. Well, again, thank you for coming on. And like you said, we just covered a small fraction of everything, but no doubt it's going to be beneficial for a lot of people. So I thank you very much. Take some time on your anniversary to come on.
Yeah, thank you so much. You have a good one.
No, you as well. God bless you.
Yeah, God bless you too.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by... Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small-batch, artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/redboxmedia. Experience coffee like never before.